about our need, our societal need. There are places in our towns and cities that have an elusive quality that maybe you and I don't see every day, but if certain people have a certain need to find them, then they do find them. Maybe it offers them some kind of like sense of privacy in public, and I think we've all got certain things that we do now and again that we don't want to share with everybody. And I think there's a nice analogy between that sense of privacy in public and a musician's performance, in the sense that it's a very private thing that's done publicly, or a personal thing that's done publicly. Hopefully this little jaunt tonight will take you to some parts of the city that you maybe don't know about, or that you haven't seen, or you haven't been there since you were a kid taking illegal substances. But hopefully the idea is that it gets you to look at your surroundings in a different way. We're going to go to three different sites tonight. They're all a very short walk from here. The length of the performance or the event will be round about 90 minutes, which is much less, you know, that's less than the standard Hollywood movie these days, so I hope you don't get bored during the duration of it. The sites are a bit kind of scummy, so do watch your feet for standing on nails or in some cases human excrement. What else do I have to say? It's possible that it might rain. We've got some brollies for you over there. If you want to take one, please do. Bryony, what else have I got to say? Thanks very much to the Arts Council for giving us the money to do this, and particularly in Dundee, DCA, who've helped us greatly with this project as well. We also do our project with them called Kill Your Typical Shit, which some of you might have come to. I always forget what else I have to say. Bryony, can you think of anything?
No.
Okay, all right. Well, then I hope you have a good night. And why don't we all walk around this?
Are you recording now?
I'm wired.
Yeah. You don't want to light up that light. Because that's bad. Because it'll feel shiny.
Right. Okay.
Don't light up the light, it'll be shiny.
Shite on the light.
Precisely the same kind of conflict. That is to say, whether I'm the kind of psychogeographer that I used to imagine I was when I was a graduate student of geography, or whether I'm the kind of psychogeographer I'm increasingly being associated with, which is the kind of psychogeography the situationists, the lecturists, invented in the mid and late 50s. They're very different. They have very different kinds of trajectories, and I come to that in a very different kinds of ways. I certainly come by my title, psychogeographer, legitimately from an academic perspective. As I say, as a graduate student, I was a student of geography, but I wrote both my master's thesis and my doctoral dissertation under the supervision of two psychologists, David Stay and Robert J. Beck. The first of whom I wrote a book called A Cognitive Atlas, Explorations into the Psychological Geography of Four Mexican Cities, and the latter of whom I wrote a book called Home Rules. Psychogeography at Clark was the product of the fact that Clark University had a very strong psychology department and a very strong geography department. And in 1967, in an effort to bring these two together in some way, they created a joint position, and geography essentially hired a psychologist who started teaching a diverse bunch of subjects that gradually became known as psychogeography among the geographers, and as environmental psychology among the psychologists. We were very interested in the interface between human behavior and the environment, and both of those very, very broadly construed. Certainly, I think in the beginning, a lot of attention was focused on an idea that we called mental maps. We had this idea that people had maps in their heads in some way, and they used these maps to organize their relationship with the macro environment. Psychogeography had, I think, a pretty good run of 5 or 6 years. It really didn't last long as an academic moment. And it transforming itself pretty generally into something called environmental psychology, which is pretty broadly taught on psychology campuses today, but which had its origin in this nexus of activities. It wasn't as a psychogeographer, however, that I got involved in the shadowed spaces. I was doing some really simple, straightforward geography. A colleague of mine, a cartographer named George McCleary, and I were teaching a course in Over the Water. And in the course of that course, we took all of our students to every bit of open river in the city of Worcester, Massachusetts. And most of these were fence. We were going to save the water for the people and to save the people from the water. So we were constantly climbing over fences, or climbing under fences, and investigating spaces that weren't supposed to have any people in. Wherever we went, we found signs of human habitation, occupation, and utilization, such as you see all around here. That is the same as the walls and the village, or clearly such signs of the broken bottles, the snack cans, the bags, the cast off clothing, and so forth. What were these doing in these spaces that were closed to people? Now, well, in a way, I look back on this and I'm like, how naive could I be? It's not like I was discovering these things for the first time. Certainly, growing up, I had found the shadowed spaces, and I had used the shadowed spaces, and I had celebrated the shadowed spaces. It's pretty hard to live in any kind of world that we live in without making use of these spaces on a fairly regular basis. So it was in a different sense of realizing that there was a system of these places and they had certain kinds of characteristics in common. And they weren't random moments in your life, that there was a whole other city, as it were, a whole other country, as it were, that was shadowed and that was utilized. And increasingly, obviously, I didn't really begin to theorize this a little bit until having talked about these spaces again and again and again, I was invited to give a paper at a criminological conference in Stockholm in 1971. And it was in doing of that that I began to theorize how these spaces might work and what these spaces might be. And I did so now drawing on sort of psychogeography. The chronology emphasis sort of forced this attention on me. And what were the shadowed spaces? They were spaces where deviant behavior took place. Now, I have a terrific problem with the idea of deviance. It wasn't because I had a terrific problem with the idea of normalcy and order. And it became clear to me that I could get rid of these ideas pretty easily by thinking about behavior solely in terms of the temporal spatial requirements that had to be met for them to take place. And it became pretty clear as it doesn't take a lot of hard thinking, that there are some activities you engage in that you don't want to engage in sure with anybody else. There are things you do by yourself, and you wouldn't do if other people were around. And then there are other kinds of things you do with small groups. You might do with a spouse, or you might do with a sibling, or a child, or you might do with your friends, and other kinds of associates. And those aren't necessarily going to be shared. That is to say that just because you're not a small member doesn't mean you're the same neighbors and the same spaces or the same people. And then you're increasing public kinds of activities, things that you're doing and are willing to do in the presence of others. And there are a bunch of things you probably pretty much exclusively do in the presence of others. So it became pretty clear I could get rid of the idea of deviance, and I could get rid of the idea of global autonomy if I just started thinking of behavior in terms of those kinds of spatio-temporal requirements. And I elaborated this in a paper called In Defense of a Space, which was published in the Journal of
looks at the screens that are required to be interposed between you and the Normandy Vine. This Normandy Vine is an interesting thing as well. The Normandy Vine, I have never seen so many Normandy Vines in my life since I've been in Scotland, although I understand there's even more in London. But the CCTV cameras that are everywhere knock me out. There's no place you can run without seeing one of these things. And in fact, often enough with a sign that tells you that you are being watched, and you're being watched for your own good. That's the Normandy Vine embodied in a peculiarly crystalline kind of way. This idea constitutes the image of something we also return as we carry around this like Normandy Vine inside our head. I didn't really like Peter Jackson's versions of the Tolkien movies, the Tolkien books, but one of the things I did like that he did was when he took Sauron's eye and just made that giant eye standing on the top of the tower. Because it really struck me that that is the Normandy Vine, and it just watches us. Of course, since we carry it around inside our own head, it's with us all the time. And it is what ultimately determines what kind of place and what kind of time we need in order to do whatever it is we might be doing. One of the great things this does is that this obligates us from thinking about deviant and normal compared to who, compared to what. There isn't any compared to anything. Since it's all going to be ultimately interpreted through your own version of that Normandy Vine, it's really what you think has to be done in private, or what you think has to be done in public. These kinds of behaviors warrant an enormous gamut. And they create, or co-create, various kinds of spaces. Two nights ago in Aberdeen, we performed in a space whose legitimacy was a shadowed space. I was all being convinced of. They didn't have enough detritus. There weren't any leaders, there weren't any cast off clothing. They lacked all the broken bottles and broken glass. It was a turned out the concept of a true gun for the performer. We would have all those things when we first saw it. I guess, if you're going to perform music in public, you can't have those kinds of signs around. And it made it really clear how fragile these spaces are. I mean, they really don't want any kind of attention. They don't really want any kind of attention. And this also focuses attention on why I was thinking about them as indefensible space. I don't know. Actually, I guess the CCTVs are part of this. But in the late 60s, a movement began to make spaces defensible. There was a perception at the time, which I'm sure you feel today, maybe even more intense, so I don't know. I never really felt it myself, and that is a complete terror that the barbarians are loose amongst us and we're going to be wiped out by the criminals and the cons and so forth. We have to constantly vigilant, constantly protecting ourselves. And in order to do this, what you do is you make spaces bright, you put public lights up every place, you lit up the trees. In fact, there's a little traffic island as you come across into the space over there. And if you poke your head in that traffic island, you'll see under those bushes exactly what you expect to see under the bushes. There's a cast-off wine bottles, there's cast-off papers and cigarette bags. The spaces are clearly used, but you can't do that when the lights are all lit up and the space is open and everybody can see everything and everything's totally invisible. Foucault's panopticon, Foucault's vision of the surveillance society, is exactly what Oscar Newman, in particular, who wrote this book, On the Defense of the Space, was trying to promote. And it certainly caught on. It certainly caught on very big with the police departments and with a lot of other public agencies. And I think we see that in the consequences of the world around us today. My feeling, however, is that the behaviors that take place in these spaces need to take place. And people are going to perform these activities, and they need spaces in which to perform it, other than whether it dies up as a people. And, you know, when I think about these spaces, I don't want to focus attention solely on deviant sexual behavior and drug use and so forth and so on. I'm also talking about all of the underground activities that take place. And we turn around and celebrate X number of years later because the stand and fail. I did a bit about early dialogue, I did a bit about the situationists. You can think, of course, about almost any revolutionary activity. The cells and seeds of which are all planted in the darkness, where, in fact, because they're opposed to authority in the most violent kind of way, have to take place out of the sight of anybody else. They're things that really, when we celebrate in the case of the United States, these are all our first presidents and revolutionary war heroes. All of these people were engaged in violently deviant behavior with respect to the British crown. So I'm not just talking about a narrow gamma behavior, I'm talking about an absolutely enormous gamma behavior. All of these behaviors call for certain kinds of spaces, and they shape those spaces. And this is a marginal example of a shadowed space right here. It's really kind of open. I think under the building is a lot more interesting as a shadowed space than right out here. And clearly that little niche back there, which is filled with somebody who's smashed a computer, and there's a broken bison back there. I don't know what those things are doing there, but I'm just trying to get rid of trash. And they were stolen goods, and they're just being off there. Who can tell exactly what they are? Those strike me as more in keeping with the core idea of shadow space. But certainly this is a marginal space. This is not a space where decent people are going to be. And in fact, one of the things I think these performances really ask is about the music that's being played here. What is it about these spaces that calls this music into being? I hope this doesn't happen tonight, but 2 months ago in Dundee, we had a heckler shouting at Tonio, who's playing the saxophone, and we had a potato thrown at us, and we had an onion thrown at us. You know, sort of the stigma on the fact that really there is something about the performances that really wants to take place in a shadow space. I think the shadow spaces have to be preserved if we're going to have any kind of human society. And I feel they're very much under assault. The real problem here is that you can't defend them in any kind of clear, articulated way, because as soon as you do that, you draw attention to them, and drawing attention to them, you're like, you can't fence it off and say that's a shadowed space. That's not how they work, and that's not how they come into being, and that's not how they maintain themselves. So, now, having said these things, I guess we can all go on to the next venue.
No, really seriously? Okay, well then, thanks very much for coming along.
I'm really interested in places in like the towns and cities where you can kind of do something that's kind of secretive. When I was growing up, I used to go to the bank where your parents couldn't see you, or maybe go to kind of drink when I was underage. So we're really interested in those kinds of spaces, because I think there's kind of secret about them, and then we do this kind of music.
Enjoy that then.
Did.
Good.